Just a reminder to put your microphones on. And Mr. Swackhammer, would you lead us in the pledge?
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Approval of the minutes, October 4th and October 25th.
Motion.
Second.
Any additions or corrections? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Jim, you're up.
All right, good morning. Give you a brief update on the radio project. The changes that we made have worked. Thank God.
Hooray. Hey, all right.
So we've been...
I really wasn't expecting you to say that. Just to put that out there.
Really? No, we finally fixed the problems, it appears, and we've been testing the system over the last several weeks, and we are actually transitioning our first units over today. So the Corning area is going to go today, followed by the Hornell area, then the Woodhull area, then it'll be the Cohocton area, and then the Bath area. We're doing it by deputy coordinator areas to make it kind of easier for us to transition. So we're reaching out to them right now and making sure that everybody's ready to go. Those that are not ready to go will stay on the low band. Those that are ready to go will go to the high band. So, so far, so good. Everything seems to be working. We are still in the process of reprogramming from the changes that we made, but the everything seems to be working. And those fire departments that were programmed previously, when we first bought the equipment, they should have the capability of being able to continue to operate on the high band fire without having to make the changes to the EMS. We'll get to those as we move through. So.
It's always good to have good news on a Monday morning, Tim. So,
oh, I know. Yep. Any questions on the radio system? And again, these were all unforeseen issues that we had with intermod between frequencies. And, I wish that we would have seen this ahead of time, but unfortunately, these things sometimes just happen. Moving on to the August 18th flood, let's talk about that one first. We are working right now with the Department of Homeland Security. They've developed an app to allow residents to go in and to submit their damages to the state for the appeal process. So we're encouraging residents to go in and do that right now. That information's been pushed out through the Human Service Agencies, through our Facebook, our social media platforms, through the mobile app. We had an event Thursday afternoon and evening at Woodhull, where we allowed residents to come in and meet with the Human Service Agencies who are distributing funding through the United Way. So United Way had about 150,000, I think, in a first round, and about 110,000 in the second round. A lot of support from Corning Incorporated, Corning Foundation, as well as Wegmans stepped up to the plate and gave a $40,000 donation to United Way for flood relief. Some of that's been matched by Three Rivers Development and some of the other partners within that agency. So we've got about 110,000 right now that we're dishing out to residents to try and help them. Lowe's in Hornell donated some flooring. I think they donated 100 boxes or something like that of flooring to ProAction, and ProAction's working with residents to try to distribute flooring out to those residents that are in need of flooring for a replacement. So we're continuing to work with DHSES to provide them with additional data. I believe that the appeal has to be into FEMA by this week. So we're working very diligently with them to try to get that information around to them. Question.
Can you explain what type of items that people can be putting in with DHS and where to do it?
So the information's on our social media, on our Facebook page. And it's also, we pushed it out through our Ready Steuben. So if you have the Ready Steuben app, it's in the messages there. But basically anybody that had damages, you know, they can report the damages, what kind of damage, how much water they had in their property or in their home. They can report whether they have furnace, hot water tank, those type of issues, and then post pictures of the damages up to the site. And what this allows DHSES to do is to go to FEMA and sit down in a room with FEMA and go through the pictures in the app and show them the level of damage that we're experiencing here that the folks have had, and hopefully play a little bit into their heart and say, you know, these folks need some help. So we've got about 350 residents documented on the 211 list of people that have called into 211 requiring or requesting assistance. I believe FEMA, Jack, help me if I'm incorrect on this. They looked at about 120 properties, if I'm correct.
Yeah, they were out here. Obviously, they didn't look at the full scope. They wanted to see the worst of the worst. And that's one of the, I had a conversation last week with our state elected officials, and they're obviously pushing as well. They wanted, at a minimum, FEMA to come back and re-review and take a look at not just the worst of the worst, but, you know, the number of basement floodings that we've had where, you know, all your HVAC systems are ruined, which are not cheap, obviously. So, you know, hopefully we make some progress. The other thing that we learned from the federal representatives, and the state is putting data together regarding this, is one of the things that they look at is number one, the state's ability, well, local government's ability, and then the state's ability to support disaster recovery efforts with funding. And I think, you know, the infusion of a lot of federal funds has, you know, kind of, I guess, colored the view of FEMA, because they're looking at New York State saying, well, you have money, why don't you just provide it? And so the state is documenting, you know, why that money that they have is encumbered and directed for certain programs. So they're working on that documentation as well.
Yeah, Tom.
Are these loans or grants? Or?
So right now it is a direct grant through the United Way. So they're providing direct funding to actually the best way that they have found it to work is to pay the contractor. So if you have a contractor and you have a quote for an estimate of damage, then you take that to ProAction or Arbor Development or Catholic Charities, mm-hmm. and then they process that through their channels and pay the contractor. So that seems to be the best way to allow it to work and happen correctly.
If FEMA gets approved, Tom, it's a combination of grants and direct assistance, low interest loans or grants, I would say.
Yeah, Tim, for those people that don't have computers or are not computer savvy, are there provisions made to help them through this process?
Yeah, I believe Catholic Charities and some of the nonprofit agencies have been helping some of the folks with that. I see Ken's on online, but when they were in Wood Hall on Thursday, I believe they were doing some of that work when they were there on Thursday. Ken, I don't know if you're there, if you can jump in. I probably caught him away from his computer. So, but yeah, that's basically how. There you go.
Too many apps on the phone. Yeah, so we pushed that information out to the municipalities, you know, and then through the social media and media chains. There's been some articles on the news that were tied in to the resource event that we held in Wood Hall that kind of dovetailed in the request from New York State for the information into that news article as well. So we're trying to push it out as best as we can. It's just a tough process sometimes to get it out to the people that are not tied into the social media and new media era. So we're working on that though.
Thank you.
Jack, has anyone indicated the likelihood that FEMA will come back around with an approval for individual assistance?
No, not in a way that, you know, gives us any assurance. They've said they've seen them change their mind, and then other times they stick with it. You know, they're making the case, but no one's really said, oh yeah, we have a really good chance of that, or this just isn't going to happen. So we haven't heard either way. I think that's why I think we're leaning back on, if they don't reverse their decision, then at least come back out and do a more thorough IA review. And so they can say they saw virtually all sorts of damage, not just the homes that were completely destroyed.
Right. Okay.
So on the public assistance side, we've held two applicant briefings so far. One of those we hosted at the Civil Defense Center for towns that didn't have the capability of being able to log into an online format. So right now, the towns and the municipalities should be applying to that for that public assistance process. Applications have to be in, Ken, correct me if I'm wrong, by the 8th, am I correct, or is it the 6th?
It's the 4th, I believe.
4th. All these dates just run together for me anymore. So applicant briefings have to be in by the 4th. So make sure your municipalities that suffered damages, they get their applications in so that they are in as part of the system for the reimbursement. So we're working with very closely with Soil and Water Conservation, DPW, and the municipalities on that. We push the information out to all the towns, but again, sometimes towns don't read stuff until a week or two later, you know, and it might be too late. So make sure your towns know that. Okay, so into this weekend's event. We started Thursday. I started looking at the forecast discussions and some of the things that were coming in Thursday in regards to this past weekend's rain. I didn't have a good gut feeling about it. They were predicting about an inch of rain, inch and a half for us. Our flash flood guidance was right around an inch and a half for 3 to 6 hours. My concern primarily was the amount of water that was still in the Cohocton watershed. As Mr. Malter could probably tell you, up around the Atlanta area, all the wetlands up through there are just absolutely soaked, and all of that feeds into the Cohocton River. So I was very concerned about that, had conversations with Jack, and we were prepared for what might come. Certainly, as has been the indication with National Weather Service over the last couple of months, their rain estimates were low. Our rainfall totals averaged about 2.5, between 2.25 and 2.5 over Friday. So we saw flooding start around 10 o'clock in the evening on Friday. And we ended up working the overnight, just making sure things were going the way that they should. Mr. Horton was very, very, very close in Campbell. We did close the back road. We did close 125. But as far as water coming through the hamlet, it didn't get that far. It was within a half a foot, I think, of being able to come through the hamlet of Campbell and having to move the residents out of Campbell. We worked really closely with Mr. Horton's highway superintendent, Tom Austin. Certainly Tom Austin and I've been through this many, many, many times before. So one of the first calls I made was to Tom and said, you know, let me know what's going on out there. And we worked through it. So again, we got very lucky. It was one of the, first time in a long time that we've had any type of issues on the main stem rivers. Most of the situations that we've been working over the years have been flash flooding on the local streams and creeks, which we certainly had that as well. But this was certainly a main stem river, and looking at going back into our records and looking at the gauge data and saying, when the gauge gets to this level in Bath, what's it going to do in Campbell, and how are we going to prepare for that? So that's how things work this weekend. Kudos to all the local fire departments, because most of the local fire departments were out pumping basements all weekend. The groundwater level is just saturated, and we just can't take too much more rain at this point. So,
Tim, I have a question about that. What can we do in the river, or where? I sent an email this morning. You wouldn't have got it because you were in here, to yourself and Jeff Parker. Where do we even start to fix the river? The problem is the whole river needs to be dredged. I mean, we have spots along where you're saying on Savona Campbell Road, that it doesn't even take a torrential downpour now, and that road's being flooded. There's a 13-acre island in there that's normally underwater, but yet when you go down the river with a kayak in the summer, you know, a fat guy like me has to get out and walk because there's so many gravel bars in the. And is there a spot at DEC or something we even start to contact to find out?
Yeah, unfortunately, that's really more Jeff's kind of his scope of work. And that's why
I just, you know, ask the question of, you know, where we even start, because it is getting worse.
I really think that the areas that we need to start are those shoals in the middle of the river that have, you know, the full length, full grown trees in them. You know, taking out those trees and taking out those shoals that, you know, those gravel bars that have become islands now, you know, that's the best way. But trying to get DEC to approve that type of work is a big, big question, because they like it as fish habitat and other types of habitat. And it's very, very difficult. So Jeff's really the main guy, because he has the connections with DEC and the permitting issues. He knows the permitting issues. So I really think that's the direction. But, you know, I've had some concerns for a while, too, down on the main stem Tioga coming up into Irwin with the gravel bars and the islands that are there with the grown up trees, because certainly when they put the levee system in 70, you know, after the 72 flood in Irwin, you know, those gravel bars weren't there. And so it was built for a level of so many cubic feet per second. And now that level of cubic feet per second has certainly gone down because of the gravel bars and the trees and everything that's in the river. So this has been a big question by a lot of people, is what do we do with these streams and these creeks and that have all these gravel bars in them? How do we manage that? So it's just something that, you know, we got to work with Jeff on. Bob?
I'm on the Soil and Water Board, and the biggest problem with DEC is we've kind of nicknamed her the Muscle Queen. And if there's any muscles in there, they're more valuable than humans.
Well, I could tell you in the past, in the 70s and 80s, and especially in the 80s, when I was supervisor in the town of Whalen, it was a normal procedure for the towns to go in and clean these creeks out. And I know at one time I had flooding in Patchensville, declared an emergency, and brought a crew in, a drought in, to clean out the creek, and got called to Avon by DEC. But I showed them the town law that allowed me to do that with notification. And I don't know any other mechanism in order to clean these things out anymore, how to do that. So.
Yeah, and again, I mean, right now, following a flood, you know, with local states of emergencies and things like that, you know, there might be some potential to be able to do some emergency permitting. But, you know, again, Jeff's the guy. It's got to kind of walk you through that process.
All right. I'll pursue with him. And I mean, because everybody comes out during the middle of it and offers help.
Absolutely.
A couple of years ago when there's the ice jam, I mean, the governor's office themselves called, and I was wading out into water to let some cows out. And I told him I didn't have time to talk to him. Call us in the summer when we can fix the problem. You know, I mean, and that's my true feeling. They call when we're in the middle of it. Well, you know, you're 4 hours away with a long stick excavator. You can't help us. You know?
Right. Right. Absolutely.
So, but thanks for the information.
Parker will tell you it is a constant battle trying to get the DEC to do anything in any of the streams. I've been after them for a couple of them on the Tioga in Lindley, where creeks come down and wash in, and they're creating such a gravel bar that it's eating away on the side of the river towards houses. And he's like, he said, I've known this problem for 10 years. And he said, we just can't get them to let us do anything to, you know, to try to prevent it. So it's kind of ridiculous. I am almost of the opinion with John, you just go in and start cleaning stuff out and then ask for forgiveness later.
Is he going to be in for Public Works? Yeah. Okay.
Thanks, Tim.
All right. Last item is the approval of the state interoperable communications grant. This is for our communication system upgrades. And specifically with this one, I'm really kind of going to try to focus on updating the, I want to update the Pinnacle site. I'm working very closely with DEC and State Parks. There's a transition of property there that's going on at the State Park at Pinnacle. Parks is going to be turning that property over to DEC. We have some equipment that's currently at the clubhouse. The clubhouse is going to be torn down. So I'm working closely right now with them to try to identify where we could potentially go there on that site to build a tower and have a tower site and a communication site there. So hopefully this grant will really focus on getting that project up and going once all the approvals and everything are through. We're really at the beginning stages of this, but this is what I'd like to use this funding for, because we've got voids down the 99 corridor and also down the 417 corridor in Addison, Tuscarora that we need to kind of fill with that site. And if we lose that site, we're gonna lose quite a bit. So this is $766,339. And this is a direct funding, no match.
Second.
Discussion. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried.
Okay.
It's a shame what's become of the Pinnacle. If you ever play golf there and then you go up there, it's an absolute waste. But I hunted pheasants there Wednesday. So the state is putting out birds at least and utilizing the land for something.
So the plan is to turn that back over to DEC and make it reforested land. So it'll be available for hunting, fishing, and those type of things. I believe the pavilion and, that area up on the upper side will still remain there, but the rest of it's going to become forested land. And what we're looking to do is acquire a piece of property that would be out toward the road, toward the Ackerson's roadside, that would allow us to put a tower site up there and have our equipment there so that we can fill that void that we have right now. So.
I'm glad you didn't do it earlier, because I probably would have ended up hitting it with a golf ball. I'm never really that good out there.
Yeah. Well, if you hit where the baseball field or softball field is, that's kind of the area that we're looking at right now. So, all right. Thank you.
Sheriff.
Morning.
Morning.
My first item is to accept what used to be the crackdown grant, which is now renamed by the state to the high visibility enforcement grant.
Motion.
And
okay.
Thank you.
Because I like the name.
It's in the amount of $17,500.
Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried.
Thank you. Second item is the bulletproof vest. This one is a matching grant. This covers corrections, road patrol, and probation. So our budgeted amount would be $17,100 in order to receive back up to $8,550.
Motion. Second.
Discussion. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried.
Perfect. The next one is the Sheriff's Office portion of the Homeland Security Grant. Tim's already presented on the overall grant. This is the $30,500 that would come to the Sheriff's Office.
Motion.
Second. Yeah, I noticed that this was for the SWAT team. Yep. And I was wondering what it is exactly.
So this goes to a bunch of different areas. For the SWAT, it's personal protective equipment, communications equipment, and new uniforms. Their uniforms are wearing out. It also goes to hardware for evidence collection. It goes to two new cameras out front of the public safety building. It goes to updated, in order to run the 360 degree Oscar camera and the ZX telephone evidence programs we have, we need expanded memory on our computers beyond what we get from the county. So that's going to purchase two of those. So it's all of those in together. We propose them to Homeland Security and they have to approve them before we can move forward. Yes. Yep. The undersheriff is very, very good at finding bargains.
Yeah, I was just going to ask if this is a little bit unrelated to the vote on this, but SWAT related. If sometime, I mean, in the last budget discussion we had, you talked about, you know, the lack of an ability for the state SWAT team to be able to respond in a timely manner.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just wondering if at some point in a public safety meeting, if maybe we could discuss, and maybe it's the discussion's been had and I just wasn't here for it, but the overall sort of goal for the SWAT team and what, you know, just the long-term plan for it and how we would utilize it in conjunction with or in comparison to the state SWAT team.
Sure. All right. We can have that discussion anytime.
Thanks.
Is it on the agenda for next meeting?
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay.
So did I get a vote on this? Did I get a motion in a second? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried.
Okay. BOCES Wildwood SRO agreement, as I told you when we approved or when you approved the SRO agreement for Coopers 2 months ago, that we were in discussion with BOCES Wildwood, which is Hornell, for the same type of service. And that has been approved to form as long as you approve it by Jen. And that's what we have as our next item. I'm looking for approval of a BOCES Wildwood SRO agreement. Again, it's a complete wash.
Motion.
Second.
Discussion. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried.
All right. Next one is the Arson Canine. I'm not looking for any resolution or anything at this time. I just want to give you information on it so that we're being transparent and communicating well. The Department of Homeland Security does teams every year where they accept applicants by need, and they do four teams a year where they provide the canine, they train the handler, and if it all works out, at the end of that, they supply the canine to the agency handler's agency with the expectation that if it doesn't work out, it comes back to the state. I've spoken with Mr. Marshall, who's in charge of the arson team, many of the arson investigators, a majority of the fire chiefs in the county. And right now there's 11 teams, accelerant canine teams in the state, across the state. And the closest one to us is in Buffalo or Binghamton. And they're looking at doing four teams this year. We're on the short list for it. And should we be accepted into the program, they would train the handler and supply the canine. The costs would be to outfit the vehicle and to pay for the actual room and board for the training. I've approached the Sheriff's Foundation. They've agreed to pay for those costs so that it would be no unbudgeted costs to the county in the next year should we move forward with it. The accelerant canine is different than the patrol canines we have in that it doesn't do patrol work. It doesn't do tracking work. It's specifically to detect accelerants at a suspicious fire location. Over the past 5 years, we've increased our presence in the arson investigation team to support EMO to where now every suspicious fire in the county, one of our trained arson investigators responds and assists EMO in that investigation. This accelerant canine would be an integral part of that. It would be a benefit to every fire department in the county, and it would be a big benefit, I believe, to emergency management and to our team of investigators. Currently, it's a 3-hour wait at least for one, if we can get one, if there's one available. And this would have one here in county for use. They estimate the team typically lasts for about 10 years, and it's viable for that. Of the 11 teams statewide, seven of them are teamed with a sheriff's office or a police department.
How many investigations do we do a year? As far as
50 to 60, we're a little down this year.
Yeah, typically it's our high that we've done has been in the 60s. Our low has been in the 40s.
How often do we need a arson canine?
Depends on the situation, but you know, usually about.
Can you get near a microphone?
Mm-hmm. Our goal would be to use it on every suspicious fire investigation.
Typically, we use a canine about a half dozen times a year, six to eight times a year. But there are certainly times where we could use a canine more often if we had one available to us. But to specifically call for one in the situation, because we know this is definitely a situation where we need a dog to verify the information, then that's about six times a year. But we could certainly use it probably about 20 or more times a year.
So do we have a deputy assigned to these fire investigations at this
point? We have four. We have three investigators and a deputy that rotate through them.
One of them would be the handler? Yes.
That's one of the prerequisites for the program, that the handler has to be an arson investigator.
Is there a cost now when a dog comes in?
No. It's
not ours?
No. It's a state dog. It's just the process of our... I'm sorry. It's a process of us being on scene for 3 hours waiting for a dog to get there. The dog typically comes from the state. If the dog's available, it takes about 3 hours to get there.
Are there other counties in the region who?
Not that I'm aware of.
Interested in a dog?
Not that I'm aware of. And that's something else that we could potentially look at, is if we had a dog here in Steuben, we could potentially look at a mutual aid agreement with any of the coinciding counties to assist them with investigations if need be. And that's something we could look at if we needed to enhance its capabilities.
Cost sharing?
Yeah, absolutely.
I'd be interested in knowing what other counties around here would be interested.
So the first year is covered by, I think you said, the foundation. Mm-hmm. What are the annual costs going forward to maintain a dog patrol team?
Typically just food and vet and storage when they go on vacation.
Gary? Mr. Swackhammer, you have a question?
Yeah, it was my question, but I'll follow up. So the yearly cost, food, taking care of them, so on, who takes care of that?
So currently we take care of the majority of that through donations to the canine program.
Yeah.
And the county does pick up a little bit of it, but very, very little. I don't think we've ever exceeded more than $5,000 a year in county budget for the canines that we have currently. In my discussions with the foundation, they expressed interest in continuing this, but they only wanted to commit to 1 year at a time.
So when 1 year is up, what happens?
As far as what?
The dog.
Dog's still here.
It'll be in next year's budget request, Gary.
Yeah.
Or it might not. I mean, it's fairly safe to assume that they'll continue to support the program. And we can also explore other ways to support it through the fire departments.
So I have a question about the time that it would take a deputy to do this. Would there be overtime involved with it? And would having a dog create additional deputy time that isn't already being done for the investigations that they're already doing?
I'm not sure I follow.
Well, I'm just concerned that you may want another position next year or the year after to cover now that there's a deputy with a dog and he's doing more work, that you may want to backfill whatever he was doing before. So I'm wondering what you estimate the time sink might be from having a dog added on to what they're already doing.
So every deputy investigator we have has at least 2 to 3 hats on currently. We don't backfill because of specialized activities. None of the other canine deputies are backfilled because they're canines. We don't have that luxury. They all perform their normal tasks. This is an additional task. We already do have overtime for fire investigations because frequently they're responding when they're off duty to them. It is what it is. But as far as additional overtime for the training, that's the beauty of this canine, is that the training can all be conducted when they're working. It's much different than the patrol and tracking ones where they have to train with other dogs. This one is done while they're working. And it's twice a week, just looking for specific accelerants at a specific location, documenting that and turn it into the state. So this one is significantly different than the other canines in responsibility and hours for training.
So you don't estimate that if we added a canine dog on, that the department having a canine dog arson investigation deputy would be a factor in a request for a new deputy in a following year?
No, I do not.
Hilda? So Jim, you said that you already have four mm-hmm. already trained. So would the dog go to one of those four? Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So it's not like we're hiring anybody new to do that. You already have people trained to do it.
Correct. Right? Correct. We already have the folks trained. They would just receive the training for the canine specific and then utilize that in conjunction with the arson team.
Kelly?
Since this dog is so specialized, will it limit what the arson investigator handler can do?
No.
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 Okay.
No. It's just an added tool in the box that's going to allow us to rule out accelerants at the majority of scenes.
And so if that dog is training 2 days a week and then isn't needed,
it's not 2 days a week. It's 20 minutes, 30 minutes, twice a week.
Okay.
Yeah.
So still twice a week.
Yes.
Okay. And
during their normal work hours. It's not like they have to go somewhere for training twice a week.
Okay.
They can stop at a fire department and search for accelerants, document it, back on doing what they were doing.
So the dog would ride with his investigator handler all the time?
Yes.
Just not have to work unless you guys have a specific fire Correct. Call for it or, mm-hmm. okay. That's why the question, would it limit what that investigator would be able to do if he has the dog with him and he's doing Right. something else?
No.
Okay.
No, not at all.
So are you asking for approval or?
Nope. I'm just letting you know that I'll find out probably in February if we're accepted to the program. And then in May, if we are in fact accepted, in May, I would be looking for the county to receive the donation of the canine from the state. So until May, nothing more. I wanted to be upfront and transparent with you that this is what we're looking at doing, and this is what we're going to apply for.
So what is the value of that when you come to us in February? What do you think the value is going to be of having the canine money-wise, and what's the value of that grant?
I think the canine is valued at like less than $500 when they donate it. The value to our arson team and our fire departments is, I can't put a price tag on that.
And I believe that the dogs that they're using come from a rescue type mm-hmm. environment. So they're not specialized like the Malamars are that you use.
Malinois.
Malamars, whatever.
Not like the candy bars.
Yeah, no. It's been a long weekend, folks.
Typically, they're labs is what they typically use.
And they come from a rescue environment. They're not specifically mm-hmm. bred for this type of work. They're a right. rescue dog.
How does it help? I understand figuring out some sort of, you know, how a fire may have started, but practically, how do you think it is going to help the county to have a dog on extra investigations that we wouldn't normally call it into?
It gives us that documentation on almost every investigation of being able to rule out that accelerants were used. And that benefits not only the team and their investigations, but also the insurance companies that have to investigate after we come through.
So what happens if you find out if an accelerant was used? I don't understand.
Then the investigation kicks in earnest. Yeah. Then it has elements of either criminal activity or suspicious fire, which leads us into the criminal investigation, wherein we've made, I don't know how many arrests over the last couple of years, but it's been several.
So quite a few. We're seeing an increase in the number of suspicious fires that we have. It's just the nature of where we're at right now with our society. Having the access to a dog in these type of situations is really beneficial to the team because it reduces the amount of time that the team's going to be on scene. And again, you have to remember that the majority of the team members are volunteers. There's only a handful of paid staff that are part of the investigation team. The rest of them are volunteers. So, you know, to ask the volunteers to be on the scene waiting for a dog for 3 hours and then have to go through your investigation after that is pretty extensive. So.
Well, at this point, we're just waiting to see if you get accepted or not.
Correct.
And I guess if you don't get accepted, this is all moot.
Right. But before we went through that process, I want to make sure that you were aware of it, that you had knowledge of it, so that when I come back, I'm guessing we'll be accepted. They seem pretty positive about us. But I wanted to make sure that you had time to look at it, think about it, talk to your volunteer firefighters, talk to your city firefighters.
Just both. Let us know if you get accepted.
Yeah.
Does an arson trained or certified dog triggering on a site that it's... had accelerants, is that admissible in court?
Yes. I'm looking over to ADA Wallace and he's nodding his head yes.
I just want to go on the record and say I'm not yet sure that I'm going to vote to accept a dog if we receive one, absent more information or more discussion on long-term, you know, effects of it. But
okay,
can I ask Aaron why?
Yeah, I'm not convinced that it's going to be budget neutral, and I'm not convinced that it's necessarily worth the extra cost that we would end up putting into it.
I guess I would echo the concern. And so we questioned the whole canine program last year, and we were given a exhibition, I guess I would call it, out at the fairgrounds on what they are able to do. That was impressive and very helpful. But How many canines do we have now? Four?
Currently have four.
And one of them is, I think the last one that you got in was specialized for explosives.
Correct.
If we keep getting all these specialized canines and no other county around us has them, then we're going to be constantly helping them out at no cost to them. And I just wonder what is the benefit of us gearing up with all these tools in our box if no one else in our neighborhood is doing it as well? If you can go for 6 arson investigations a year where you could use a dog and you could get one from the state within 3 hours. I mean, I know of a house fire in Caton that the place was locked up for weeks that the owner couldn't go back to. It was not considered arson, but he couldn't get. So I think firemen sitting at or investigators sitting on site for 3 hours is not a huge task to get a state dog in.
I guess I'm not seeing the cost that is prohibitive. If we look at, I mean, what does a dog eat, right? We're not costing any extra for the investigators.
My dog would eat a cookie if it was covered.
Well, exactly. So I'm not looking at extensive costs for this, but the benefit, even if we're the only ones in the area, so we help other people, we help other counties. That's not a bad thing. That's a very good thing. And I really don't understand it.
I wasn't thinking of a few bags of Old Roy as the main cost that was going to be added on to this. I'm thinking it's going to be more in labor related costs that we're going to end up, you know, sinking real money into. But.
Well, I guess if you want further discussion, we can sit out there and put that on the agenda for next month's meeting and see what additional information we can gather. But
well, I think it would be, so we know that we have 4 canine units. Some of them are specialized in certain things. It would be nice to just hear a presentation on that entire program. And what do our neighboring counties have as far as assets, canine assets? And we can't afford to do it all.
Well, I think it would also be nice to see the labor of, you know, costs of the people who are handling the dogs related to what it was before they had the dogs. And that might help give us an idea of whether there really is extra costs, labor costs associated with them.
And so how do we do that? How do we sit out there?
Find out who has the dogs and what their labor was like before they had them and what it's like after they had them.
It would be additional overtime is what you're talking about.
So the canine program currently, they change their schedules to avoid overtime for training. There's no overtime with the training currently. they voluntarily change their schedules to make sure that they don't create overtime for training. The only overtime you really have in your canine programs is when they get called out to help another agency or our agency on tracks, searches, et cetera. That's basically the only overtime you currently have with your canines that you are housing now. They work very well to make sure to keep the cost down as low as they possibly can.
So realistically, we need to see what the bordering counties are doing as far as their canine units. Is
that absolutely. We can get that report for you.
I think that would be very helpful sitting mm-hmm. out there. Mm-hmm. Fred?
Yeah, is it possible that when our canines are on loan, so to speak, to a neighboring county, that's a billable service?
That would not be my decision to make. We've never done that because we work with our neighboring counties both ways to receive. For example, we had a rollover cement truck crash. We had no commercial vehicle folks available through the state police to help us investigate that. Livingston County sent down their commercial vehicle folks free of charge on overtime to help us with that investigation. We do that pretty consistently back and forth with our neighboring counties.
So do we keep track of those shared services?
Never have. No, really. I can, but I've never done that. We just have a working agreement with our neighboring counties.
People's concern is, are we getting a bang for our dollar?
Mm-hmm.
And the thing comes down to is if we knew that we were sharing services and getting some from other counties, and maybe we should track that.
Sure.
To make sure that we're not fitting the whole bill like Scott is indicated.
So. Right. We're not. But we can start tracking that.
Also, on shared services, I don't have an issue with, you know, helping other counties out from time to time. I just don't want to be having a whole cost center that we're sharing and then always doing the same thing over and over again, absent some sort of an agreement on it. So, you know, something happens from, you know, there's a murder or something and we send down an extra investigator because they need one, you know, I think that's one thing. But if it's, you know, we've got the canines and we're constantly sending them out to, I don't know if we are, to the neighboring counties, but.
So just to help you, every county around us, except for Allegheny, has canines. Mm-hmm. And even Schuyler has one or two. Cayuga has several. Chemung has two. Livingston has several. Ontario, I don't know what Ontario has right now. Yates County has two or three. And it fluctuates from year to year how many they have because they come, they go, they retire. But Allegheny used to have a canine. So if you're worried about our surrounding agencies having less than us, that's not the case. Typically, we're equal to or less than their programs per capita.
Anything else? So we're going to get a report as to the neighboring counties, what mm-hmm. what canines and what specialty those canines produce sitting out there, and maybe that will be helpful.
So. I'd like to see a report of the employees who are handling the dogs on what their labor is after they had the dogs versus before they had them. And I know that there's, you know, raises that naturally happen, but.
We could probably come up with an estimate. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't think
we don't have their annual incomes from past years and then what it looks like after they started handling dogs.
Oh, income. If you're looking for overtime hours and those sort of things.
Yes,
we could do that. It might not be pure apples to apples because obviously they were working overtime before.
Sure.
But yeah, we could generate a report like that. But a lot of our handlers have had these canines for years. Mm-hmm. So. You could look at the newer ones. We have a couple newer ones.
Yeah.
Past 5 years or so.
Yeah. And a lot of that's going to have to deal with raises. So if we're going back 8 or 10 years, you got raises involved. How do you factor
You know what the raises are. We know what the raises, the hourly rates are.
We just have to look at the overtime hours.
Yeah.
And again, just to be clear, they're all wearing several hats. So they're working other details for other reasons. It's not going to be indicative, but we can come up with what we can.
Well, I think if everybody who had a canine was that their payments went up more in proportion of the rest of the departments, then it would seem to me that that would be indicative that the canines are costing more labor hours. But that's what I just like to see. That may not be the case.
I think that my thought process on this is that the dog is another tool in the sheriff's department inventory of assets on how to fight crime. And we can all agree that there is an increase in many different types of crimes. And if there's an increase in fires, that I think the dog would be very useful. And if it's not changing the investigators' hours, aside from perhaps investigating more crime and convicting more people, maybe we'll prevent some crime. I mean, we pay insurance for lots of different reasons, and you pray to God that you don't need it. So a dog like this, we have him, he's a tool, and I personally think it's a good idea.
Kelly, we finally agree on something.
Oh, dear God.
Okay, we kind of beat this to death, so let's move on.
Yep.
For the real good one.
Yes, the one everybody's been waiting for. Jail medical. Our jail medical is short funds, primarily due to prescriptions and procedures outside the facility. And in order to meet our contractual and vendor obligations to the end of the year, I'm asking for a contingency fund transfer of $200,000.
So how did we get to this point, James?
Well, as I talked about last week, we had kind of a perfect storm this year in our jail medical contract runs from November to October. So each November, we start with a new threshold within the contract with Prime Care, where they cover the first 100,000 as part of our contract of prescription medicines and outside medical procedures. Within that prescription medicine, they're also paying for all of the mental health medications that are prescribed, as well as the medical medications that are prescribed, as well as if somebody has to have dialysis, if somebody has to go to Upstate Medical to have eye surgery, we've had that. If they have to have heart surgery, we've had that. Typically, we work very proactively with probation and the public defender's office and the DA's office, that if we have someone that is going to have an anticipated very costly procedure, we try to find an alternative to incarceration with those folks. Sentenced folks, we're not that lucky. If they're sentenced, we can't change that. So we get stuck with whatever it costs. Quarter four of 2020, our population skyrocketed because the state wasn't taking state-ready inmates anymore. That coincided with the time of the start of the threshold. So fourth quarter 2020, quarter one 2021, we were up at certain times, we were up over 180 folks in the jail. And we went back down quarter two once they started taking them, but they didn't take them all at once. They took a few here and then a few here and a few more here. And if anybody tested positive for COVID, they had to have a negative test before they take them. So it got stretched out and our threshold was gone by end of April. So from April forward, we were paying full boat for prescriptions, again, both mental health and medical, and full boat on any outside of the facility procedures. And Prime Care does a lot more inside the facility than we did before with private folks. So if we were still under the old scheme, it would be even worse. So we move forward.
State ready prisoners.
Mm-hmm.
I'm assuming we eat the cost of that.
They reimbursed us. That's where that 170,000 additional revenue came from. And we have another reimbursement that's supposed to come by the end of the year, but they're notorious for not adhering to any schedule or not delivering when you expect. So it may be the end of the year. It may be into the first quarter of next year. And that one should be in the tune of 150,000. So the additional revenues that came in from housing the state ready actually cover this increase in medical costs, but they don't come in to that line item.
You don't have the cash to pay the bills. That was
correct. Yes, we've got bills out there.
Paying 170,000 of additional revenue coming in that could offset this contingency fund transfer of 200,000.
Well, we already have 170 in, and we expect another 150-ish to come in.
Mm-hmm. So I guess my question is, if that money comes back in, can we move that back into contingency?
We could, but at the end of the year, it just rolls into your general fund anyhow. So that was sort of the discussion. I mean, there was two ways to do it. You could anticipate additional revenue, but my thought was we don't know exactly how much we're going to get. So I was hesitant to say anticipate the additional revenue. I mean, we have estimates, but we don't know how much and when is to do the contingent fund transfer. And then when we get additional money, it'll wash in the general fund.
Aaron.
Yeah. I read the report and I thought it made sense. My bigger question was, what happens if that money comes in next year's budget? Will we put that into contingency then?
No, we'd have to work with Tammy.
It just goes into fund balance.
Yeah, it's just rolling the fund balance.
Yeah.
Into our total fund balance?
Yes.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah, it's just a matter. I mean, we're going to have to figure out accounting. That's going to be the only rub is for your audit when that comes in, you know, whether it's recognized as 2021 revenue or 2022. But that's.
I assume at the end of this year, they would accrue for unreceived revenues.
If we had we could use that estimate.
Yeah.
And motion. We should get the report in December exactly what they're going to have for
they
that.
Should accrue for it.
Mm-hmm. I'll second it because, like it or not, we got to pay the bills.
Yeah. My question, when the original PrimeCare contract was negotiated, this $100,000 threshold number, was it based on a certain average population?
I don't know that.
Because I'm wondering if other counties that have prime care, if they're also at this $100,000 number, or if part of the negotiation, they were able to get a higher threshold.
And that's something I talked to Mr. Swaghammer about. I can research that. The other thing is, we come up next November for new contract negotiation.
That's something
something to think about. Plus, we're going to have them, we're going to do an analysis of, do we need all the folks, all the hours that we're getting? And we're going to do an analysis of that. I think there might be some cost savings there. Having a nurse practitioner there 5 days, I'm not sure that's necessary. So we'll look at that. And if we can adjust it and say we'll bring that back to this this group before we move forward with it.
So who makes the determination of one of the inmates getting this major surgery? I mean, heart operation is pretty serious stuff.
Yes. Yeah.
But, well, I know, but I mean, is it prime care that decides that?
So
smart.
So some of it is, typically if someone comes in and presents, they have protocols just as any medical provider does. If someone comes in and presents with XYZ and it's outside of the realm of what they can reasonably treat here, they send them out for tests. And then the doctor that has that says, yep, you need this or you need
this.
They
can't wait till they get out of jail. And
that's where we get those $1 million lawsuits. Gotcha. When we do that.
Yeah.
That was going to be my point on prime care.
Carol?
I'm sorry. I think prime care has saved us some of the liability that we have been seeing in the past. And I would encourage us to not walk away from prime care.
Yes, they've done a tremendous job with that.
Good point.
We still do have liability, though.
Okay, so I have a motion and a second. Further discussion? Aaron?
Where did the $100,000 number come from?
It's in the contract.
Yeah, but was that something that we had looked at trailing?
That's
numbers
their standard contract. That's,
okay.
Yeah.
That's right. What I asked.
Yeah. Oh, I didn't understand if that's exactly what you're asking or related question. Okay.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair.
Everybody have a wonderful day.
Brad?
Can I ask a question of the sheriff?
Uh-oh, I thought you were going to get away.
Yes, sir, Mr. Potter.
The governor just in the last few days signed a new law on loud vehicle exhaust systems controls.
Okay.
And it's a substantial fine. It's like $1,000 fine for that. Have you got any information on it?
No, none.
And are we going to have the resources to enforce that?
That would sound like something that will probably go out to the state police for enforcement. Most vehicle and traffic things of that nature, she can push out directly to them. But we'll have every week we have a conference call with the Sheriff's Association. So if she signed it, I'm sure that'll be on this Thursday's call. And I'll have more information for you after that.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Yep. No worries.
Before you leave, another one. So what's the status of sticker stores? Have you heard any more?
So there were two that were going to start in the city of Corning. I heard that are reevaluating that. There's one in the village. It's shared between the village of Riverside and the city of Corning. Mm-hmm. And we've had meetings with all of our law enforcement partners on that. And we are actively investigating that. The issue is under the cannabis regulation or marijuana regulation taxation act, there's no clear cut violations for that. So what we're doing is we're researching with our state police partners as to the tax evasion end of that. And I think that's probably going to be a much bigger thing. The act of selling unlawfully is a violation. So there's not much there unless it's a person under 21. So we're going to continue in that. And we will be, I've been in conferences with the district attorney, the state police and the city Corning Police Department. We are actively moving forward.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a time frame of when this might be resolved?
No, I do not.
Okay.
And I talked to your mayor in Riverside about this last week and briefed him on it too.
Okay. That store has a history. I mean, I've been told you could walk in there. A young person can walk in there as long as they have a college sweatshirt on. They aren't ID'd for buying alcohol.
So we are continuing forward with that, trying to finish our research as to what our actual ability will be enforcement wise before we make case law.
Thank you.
Yep.
Thank you.
Anything else? Okay. Thank you.
Run, Sheriff, run.
Okay. It's my time.
Mr. Wallace. Mr. Wallace.
Yes. I'm going to wait Nate up. He fell asleep back
there. Nate, did he wake up?
I'm going to let Nate take the beginning here.
Good morning.
Morning.
We're requesting to a reclassification in the district attorney's office of a vacant paralegal assistant position, which is a full-time position, to a part-time office manager position. And this is as a result of the study that was done in the DA's office.
Motion.
Second. Discussion. All in favor?
Aye.
Motion carried. You want to add something to that, Mr.?
I have a question.
Okay.
Being part-time, do we or have we seen a schedule of what this part-time person's going to be doing and hour-wise?
Hour-wise, no. However, duties-wise, yes. And I've already spoken back and forth with the DA that it's going to be under 20 hours a week. So it'll be a less than half-time employee. And what I had told the DA was my requirement was that it stay a less than half-time position. So if it were going to go above that, we would have to have a discussion before it did.
Who's keeping track of half-time?
Well, it's kept track of on payroll. So we're going to see the hours that they're worked, you know, and if we see it going above, just like we do, and the sheriff will tell you I'm on him all the time. If, you know, if we have part-time people that, you know, go above their half-time hours. So they have to, they clock in and clock out for their hours.
So is there going to be a set time that person comes in daily, or?
That's going to be up to the department. What we control is the number of hours.
My input would be, I would hope that the person would be in there daily to, you know, to be able to keep things flowing that regularly.
Think so. Hopeful. Yeah.
It would certainly, in my opinion, be better to be in there smaller hours daily than once a week if you're an office manager, but.
That's our plan. We expect them to be there every day, but not all day.
I would expect the same thing.
But I would think initially that person is going to put some hours in just to get initiated as to what's going on. So you might see some additional hours sitting out there initially. So,
and as the DA wholly admitted in his presentation, the key is him giving up control. That's correct. What's going to make this successful.
And if the guy isn't there, if the guy isn't there,
All right. Thank you. Anything else?
I'm sure he really missed visiting the legislature this morning. Tell him nice work.
He sends you his best, Aaron.
Yeah, all good. Anything, Jack? All right. Motion to adjourn.
Motion.
Have a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed or adjourned? Thank you.
They did? Okay.